Welcome to the Healing the City podcast. The following podcast is a ministry of the Village Church in Tucson, Arizona. If you wish to support the Healing the City podcast, you can go to the show notes, click support the show, and you can become a subscriber for $3, $5, or $10 a month. This will help offset the hosting costs and continue the ministry of Healing the City podcast. Also, if you wish to support the show, we really encourage you to rate us on Apple and Spotify and other places that podcasts are listened to, and give us a good review. Thanks. Welcome to Healing the City Podcast, Sermon Remix, John Chapter 6.
John Chapter 6. Are we going to do a brief recap of John Chapter, the end of John Chapter 5? Because
recap of the end of John Chapter 5.
Yeah, we missed all of John, the end of John Chapter 5.
Yeah, so we were podcasting and the power went out and we lost all of that podcast.
That's just the second part of chapter 5.
Which we were just about to finish.
It was so good.
It was maybe the best podcast we've ever done.
Ever. It was amazing. We were on fire.
We can keep building it up and up and up because no one will ever listen
to it. Right?
Well, I did do a little short commentary that'll go up on 5:24. So
good. Well, it was
covered a little bit of it.
It basically was the, like, where do you find your the end of your sermon was where do you find your glory and your honor, and are you getting it from other people or are you getting it from God? Is there space for God to speak what is true about you, even like because you're pulling that from other people instead,
like, right?
But you should go listen to Eric's sermon. Right. And see if you can get all the quiz questions correct.
Yes.
Prior to the kids answering or Eric answering for
them. Yes, that was the highlight of that sermon. It was. Oh, and I should probably text Jim. I saw him today. He's preaching this week, but he's got mid-kids in the service, so
okay.
I need to give him a heads up.
Oh, I was going to say, did you forget to give someone $2? Or
No. They all got to it.
$2.
To it very quickly.
Oh, man.
And then somebody didn't. One kid actually rejected the money. It's like, no, didn't want it.
The knowledge that we learned today was enough.
It's enough for me.
That was enough payment.
But yeah, you can find it online on YouTube on the Village Church in Tucson's YouTube channel under the live replays.
You can, or you can listen to it on the podcast.
Yes, the other podcast.
The sermon podcast.
Yes, Church in Tucson sermon podcast feed. Yeah, go ahead.
It was 3 weeks ago, though, now, so we don't have a ton to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back and listen to it, it is Jesus saying he comes from the Father, and he and the Father are one, and it's a big dialogue about how he's basically God.
Yeah. And let's just mourn together the loss of the best podcast ever. Yep.
But a lady came. This morning or Sunday morning, I think her name was Angela, and she has been listening to Village Podcast since 2020 on Spotify.
Since
2020, she's been following us.
She told me that she listened to us on Spotify, and I was like, "Oh wow, that's awesome!" Like since in the last like, couple weeks, that's amazing.
Yeah, and she said to me, she was talking about stuff, and then she's like, "Oh, one of the illustrations I remember was you talking about." Parkas. Because I'd given this illustration about how one might interpret scripture. And so if Paul was writing to a particular people and he was writing to people in North Dakota and he was talking about the importance of wearing your parka. And then here we are in Arizona where it's 110 degrees reading about how important it is to wear our parkas, but we're sweating to death, that some things are in context and we have to understand scripture
in
its context. And to its original audience. And so that was really meaningful to her. And I was like, oh, yeah, gosh, I haven't thought about that since that sermon. But, you know, that was...
That's awesome.
Yeah, so, you know, that was cool. Thanks for listening and coming and visiting our church.
Yep.
Come back.
And here's the thing. She used to go, before 2020, to the Village, Red Rock. Oh,
in Red Rock, yeah.
And they don't know anything about us. So we should probably email them and say, hey...
Cease and desist using our name.
Yeah, cease. No, like, hey, man,
can we? We tried that with Matt Chandler, but he was like, who are you?
I should just send him a joke letter. Dear Matt and family, please stop using the village name. We unfortunately haven't trademarked it. I don't think you can anyway.
That's all right. That's all right.
I'm sure there's a lot of village churches out there.
Yes. So just in case you're confused, we are the Village Church in Tucson, Arizona. That's right.
This is the Healing the City podcast. And last Sunday, the Sunday, Mark preached on the entire chapter of John 6.
Which was a lot.
And he has a lot of text.
So this is old school. This is how the village used to do it. Huge chunks of text. And we've gone back to that to get through the whole thing. And it's good because you get the whole sense of scripture read over you, at least, at a minimum.
Yeah. Picking out what to read. Because if you read all of it during like the scripture reading time, mm-hmm. and all the kids are sitting there and like fiddling and sitting around. And so picking out exactly what to read for the scripture reading time was actually
60 plus verses or something.
It was 71 verses. So what to read. So I picked like the one of the two stories and then a brief thing about the bread of life and then Peter's response at the end of the chapter. So I think it ended up being something like 14 verses instead of 71 verses. But I think it summarized the chapter fairly well. But then we got to read the whole thing during the sermon, which was good.
So let's talk about it. Jesus heads out to the wilderness. The crowds follow him. This is where Philip shows up, getting asked about food.
Yep.
Is there enough food? And then the 8 months of wages. And then there's the barley bread and fishes of a mm-hmm. little boy get multiplied. And there are 12 baskets left over. Which I always thought, so as a kid, I would read this over and over again. I thought, how did they get those leftover scraps? Is it just stuff people are like, I bit this bread. It's not that great. I'm going to throw it on the ground.
Where'd they get 12 baskets? Where'd the baskets come from?
Somebody was carrying a basket out into the desert.
Was it carrying like their blankets so they could lay down on the grass?
Probably.
Something like that.
There's maybe some mules.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe there were boats. So you get the idea that there were boats.
Yeah, there were some boats. Yep.
Because the crowd later leaves in boats.
Yes.
Which is kind of interesting because I got the impression that there was maybe too many people to fit in boats.
There was a lot of boats.
I got the impression that there was like a ferry service.
Oh, okay. That could be. That actually would make sense.
Because it says that some boats came from Tiberias.
Okay.
And I wonder if maybe there's like kind of a regular like crossing happening.
Sure. Yeah. And you know, in the Sea of Galilee or the Sea of Tiberias, which was an interesting little reference.
Yeah.
Which I have a thought about that later, but anyway, it's not huge. It's not a really, really big sea.
Yeah.
It's what, like 2 miles, 3 miles in diameter or something like that.
Yeah. But apparently even now it occasionally gets really, really gusty winds.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, that's when they talk about like the storms that whip up on the Sea of Galilee. You're like, well, it's like a lake, right?
Right.
Like, it's not huge, but apparently the winds, because of the topography of the land, like the winds get really strong at times and whip up big waves.
Right. So my thought though on the Sea of Tiberias, so Eric made some kind of reference to this. I can't remember if it was while we were podcasting or during his sermon, but there is a really strong argument to make for John being written before AD 70.
Yes.
Because it's said about various features in the text, like the geographical features, the architectural features, like these kind of things. It's all present tense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like if you go kind of in the style of saying, this is a little bit ad lib, but the style of saying, if you go to Jerusalem, this is what you will find, right? Yeah. Like this is where this is, right? Explaining it for people who are not super familiar with Jerusalem, super familiar with Israel, super familiar with the province of, I forget what they called it at the time, at one point Judea, mm-hmm. and I think later they called it some other kind of province. But anyway, like he's explaining, right? So he says like the Sea of Tiberias, because that's what the Romans would have called it, right? He explains the porticos around the pool of Bethesda. Yeah. Bethesda, right?
Bethesda.
Right?
Bethesda.
Yeah, exactly. And I had occasion to talk with Ron Brown again, and like that is also a case for its historicity, right? That this is not just crazy, weird mythology.
Right.
Because if you were making a myth, you wouldn't tend to put this kind of crazy level of detail
down.
The real
detail.
Yeah. I mean, it's not impossible. I mean, it's not like an ironclad, you know, complete 100% case for it. But I mean, it is kind of interesting that that John puts in all kinds of crazy detail that doesn't need to be there if he's just constructing a myth.
He also does not explain, like, what he means when it says, like, the Passover feast was near. He doesn't explain what Passover is. Like, he's probably writing to mostly Christians who were at least familiar with the Jewish, like, tradition and stories. And the church had not largely moved away from a Jewish background yet.
Yeah, it's interesting what he includes and what he doesn't. Yeah. So, I mean, sometimes almost all the gospel authors, but John, I know for sure because I've been looking at it recently, will say this thing in Aramaic and then translate it into Greek because he's trying to keep in mind his audience. And sometimes he does explain things about, like, the Samaritans and the Jews, for instance, like explaining what the relationship between the Samaritans and the Jews is for his audience. Yeah. So, yeah, there are some things that he thinks that he knows, they know, and some things that he thinks need explanation.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to go back to the historicity of things, like, I believe that you can genuinely say that these guys all believed that it happened to them.
Sure.
There's enough evidence that at least they believed it.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. But I guess what I'm saying is, even apart from that, these little details about geography that you can then go and verify are pretty interesting, pretty cool for that case.
Yeah.
And I don't like the more secular or anti-Christian, anti-religious stance of people to try and inflate the numbers on the book of John. Oh, yeah, it was not written until 240 AD. Yeah,
those numbers are crazy.
But if you go look around the internet, you know, and around scholarly documents, they'll often make those kinds of wild claims, and I just don't buy it.
No.
Yeah, I don't think that's reasonable.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, the Sea of Tiberias is an interesting little note. The Sea of Galilee. But the boats going back and forth are really interesting, too, because it feels like some boats come maybe to, like, pick up the crowds or something the next day. It's almost like they walked out. They were like, we're going to go find Jesus, and you guys bring the boats back across so we don't have to, like, walk back or something. Like, there's something happening where these boats come from Tiberias and they get in them and they go back. So there's the feeding, and then Jesus walking on water is the other story.
Mm-hmm.
It's always funny to me that it seems like they're not going to let Jesus back in the boat until he's like, it's me, don't be afraid. And then the whole conversation about bread of life, which happens in Capernaum on the other side of the Sea of Galilee, while he's teaching in the synagogue.
Which is a very important spot for the Gospels, if you have that in mind. If you just kind of keep in mind all the times that Capernaum is mentioned and all the teachings that are happening in and around Capernaum, it's a very important focal point of Jesus' ministry.
Yeah.
Which I don't know. I just got really a lot into geography. Partially because my neighbor, Mark, keeps asking about maps and where things are. He does.
He's very excited about maps.
He's very excited about maps.
And, you know, and I'm into it, too. I have that extra little push.
Yeah, I love maps. I just can, I don't know.
No, you don't need to do it. It's my thing. It's all right.
Yeah, that's good. So one thing I was going to raise my hand and add to this. So there's all this allusion to Israel crossing the Red Sea, heading into the wilderness, the manna, and you made a lot of those links. There's the little line about he knew that they were going to make him king, and so he left. It's interesting when Moses goes to Pharaoh first and says, hey, let us go out, you know, let us go out and have a feast out in the desert. Well, that is how you welcome a new god, is you have a big feast. And so they want to go out. This is part of why Pharaoh doesn't want to let them go, is that Pharaoh's like, no, you're not going to go out there and welcome a new god to challenge all these gods, my gods and me. But it's an idea. They were going to, can we go out and have this celebration, this feast, to usher in our king? And so there's Steve. I just that made me think when you were talking about all the allusions to being in the desert and Yahweh providing. And Jesus is the one who's Yahweh, and he's providing, and he's providing the better food, and he's the bread of life, and yet he's like, yeah, this is not my time to come out as God.
Yeah.
At least I'm going to say it is in every way possible. But right now, you're not going to make me king. I'm not going to be the ruler.
Yeah, and so the way he goes away is he goes further up the mountain to the point where even his disciples are not following him.
Right. Well, it's interesting because they can't go back to Capernaum. So if he's in Capernaum at the synagogue, the crowd is not going to rise up and make him king there. Like, the reason they're trying to make him king in the wilderness is because there's this big crowd with him. They make the 5,000 men.
Mm-hmm.
They make him king there, and then they have a big procession, which is eventually what happens, is he has this procession into Jerusalem as the coming king, and the people receive him. But that's what would have happened, is they would have made him king, and then they'd have this procession back to Capernaum, or maybe even down the other side and cross the Jordan to Jerusalem and say, here is our king. Like, if he goes back to Capernaum, it's harder for them to rile up the people and to lift him up, especially with the Jewish leaders there arguing with him and and being upset with him.
I honestly don't think 5,000 people got in boats. I think the people crossed are the people who've been following him for a while.
Everybody else
kind of went home. I think the numbers probably dwindled quite a bit.
Yeah.
Because then you move to these conversations about the disciples. And it seems like he had a larger crowd of disciples, or people who considered themselves disciples.
Yes. Well, there were a lot of people who followed him, and then there were the 12.
Right.
Like, there's these circles that you can see of closeness to Jesus through his ministry.
Yeah, it seems like there's maybe three, because there's the crowd, which is a lot of people.
Yeah.
Not necessarily people who we would call disciples. There is the disciples who are unnamed and larger than the 12.
Yep.
And those are the ones we lose a lot of by the end of the story.
Yeah.
We lose a lot of the crowd, but the crowd's always kind of coming and going. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it gathers around Jesus in the stories, and sometimes it's gone.
Very much responding to the miracles. And,
exactly. Yes. Yeah, which is, I mean, he nails that right here in this chapter. That is a huge piece of what's going on.
Yep.
It's why the crowd is gathering. But yeah, there's this disciples, and then there are the 12, which we often call the disciples, but sometimes that language is not enough.
It's not helpful. When you think of the disciples as the 12, then when you read the disciples at other places, you lose the sight of it. Actually, there's like a lot of other people following him. Yeah. Yeah. There's also like an even more inner circle, which is Peter, James, and John, who are there at particular moments.
Yeah, so with your chief of staff analogy.
That's good.
You know, that you kind of get that piece of it. I was trying to think if I agreed with John as the chief of staff. I mean, it was good for your analogy because I wouldn't want to try and assign like...
I mean, the analogy only goes so far,
sure,
right?
No, I get it.
Workshopped...
He's the chief of staff, then what's Peter? Is Peter that... Yeah, anyway.
I workshopped that analogy with Lane for a while before we came up with chief of staff.
No, it's good. It's good. It was a good one. Yeah, yeah. So to just over-explain for those who haven't listened to the sermon
Listen to the sermon.
John is writing as if he was the chief of staff for a president looking back on the presidency, and that's kind of the style of the story of the gospel that he writes is you want to know about his time in the presidency with the president. You don't want to know about, or maybe he wouldn't have needed or thought to have written about his childhood, his, you know, young upbringing. He's going to hit the really important events that he was directly there for.
And he's not necessarily writing detail by detail, day by day. Mm-hmm. He's drawing out particular stories to talk about particular themes of Jesus's ministry, which is different from what you see in Luke, where Luke's trying to give this account of
from beginning
Jesus
beginning to end,
from beginning to end.
It seems so. Just to kind of, as we kind of move towards the end of the podcast, what you pinpointed in on was the question, really. Of, you know, are you going to leave me too? And the proclamation of Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's really interesting there is, and this kind of came out in some of the comments in the evening, but this is like the world is dirty, messy, and And so, and yes, it's a great proclamation, but it's also, what else do we have? Like, there's, as Emily McConnell said, there's like nothing. You're it. Like, it's almost, it's a joyous resignation at some ways. Like, yes, we're getting good things from you, but there isn't any other place. And it's not fixing everything. You're like not doing our agenda, which is interesting, because then if you head to chapter 7, which we'll kind of do a prelude, there's this, you know, the brothers of Jesus are like, I'm not so sure you're the Messiah. Like, you need to go present yourself as somebody who's great. And the crowds are like, who's trying to kill you? You're like, you have a demon. Like, are you demon possessed? Yeah. So there's like a lot of like wrestling with, if you're the Messiah, like, what are you? And I feel like even after the resurrection, 2,000 years later, that is sort of where we are as disciples. It's like, we're having to come to terms with how God is moving the world towards an end. Like, and it's messy and very complex.
Yeah.
And it doesn't do all that. Jesus does not do what I want him to do. And I think that's kind of where I kind of settled in at the end of your sermon was, well, yeah, I'm willing to make that proclamation. And some of this was alluded to, but I'm also willing to make the proclamation of Peter later on, which is, I don't know who you are.
Yeah.
I've never seen him.
Well, and to be...
I'm not even Galilean.
And to be restored that, again and again.
Yeah.
Which Peter...
At the very end of that.
At the very end of John is restored to his place again and again, because he walks away from Jesus in the end. I do think the reflection for me, you know, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of life. We believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. That confession, to me, I mean, the reason I drew it into communion, well, communion's an obvious place to go with bread of life. But this idea of like, I'm coming and taking communion each week, and in between, I'm going to all these other places. You know, I'm going to, you know, food. I'm going to, you know, my spouse. I'm going to
Netflix,
alcohol, drugs, pornography, all these different places to be satisfied, to be fulfilled. And even sometimes I come to communion and I take the bread and the wine thinking, okay, this is going to make everything better. Like, if I just take communion this week, then everything's going to be better. And I'm going to be satisfied now because I ate this bread and wine, not because I am continually reminding myself of the blood and of the body and blood of Christ and like my relationship with him and my place in community and in the kingdom. And like that, we come to communion each week trying to find something or fix something, often, rather than sitting with Jesus and the reality of this, his body and blood poured out is the thing that satisfies, not all the things that came between, and not specifically this bread and this wine. Like, if I take this bread and wine every week, I'm going to feel better.
Yeah.
Like, it's not about feeling better and feeling satisfied right now. It's about a life of living in Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I liked about your verbal proclamation is something that, as I was been thinking about 5:24 and just the whole hearing and believing, is that I was listening to a neurobiologist, and they're talking about how if you're like, and particularly when you do public speaking, everybody, no matter where you're at, like even if you have it down, there's at least a tiny tinge of anxiety. But if you're just a normal person, you have high tinges of anxiety, which means that when you get up there, you have all this cortisol firing, and that's why, you know, how your memory, things will just kind of narrow in, or you'll start forgetting information. It's because you got the cortisol firing, and it's trying to figure out what's the essential thing for us to survive this moment. But if you go before that, you go look at somebody else and you tell them, I am so excited to go stand up in front of all these people and talk. I'm just so excited. Your brain is like, what the heck is going on? Like, and it won't fire the cortisol because it thinks it's in trouble because you have all this anxiety. But now you're saying, your rational brain is saying, this is great. Like, we're doing, like, I'm so excited about this. And I think that's partly what is so profound about what you did with communion and asking us to proclaim Peter's words out loud is that you're asking us, in a sense, to counter what we experience as reality. And we live in a high anxiety world. So we have inordinate amounts of cortisol firing all the time. Like, we all are kind of in fight or flights most of the time. So Jesus really offers us in that story, or Peter offers us, an opportunity to really kind of counter what we think is real, and say what is real, even if we're not internally experiencing that way. And it will actually help us. It will help us center on Jesus and on what is good and right. So I was excited about that. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think my hope is that we would take communion more intentionally. Like, even the reading of it slows you down in the moment. So you're not just walking up, grabbing the bread, dipping the wine juice, walking away. Like, that there is a slowing down and saying, I have to read this thing out loud. Mm-hmm. Like, so it is, some of it is the specific words, and some of it's just the thinking about, what am I doing right now? I am taking the bread and the wine. I'm taking the body and the blood. Like, this is an intentional thing that draws me into relationship with Jesus. It does slow me down.
It's good. Yeah. It's really good. And just on a side note, now that we've gone to two services, there are many times where I'm like, huh, I take communion twice a day on Sundays. This is awesome.
You can.
Yeah. And I did in particular on that last Sunday, because I was like, I want to go up there and say this thing. So sometimes, you know, as elders, I managed to get in once with God and communion, but we're, you know, doing.
Sometimes you're bouncing around doing other things and you don't get it in one service. But
Yeah.
But even if you're not an elder, you can come and take communion twice on Sunday.
Yes, you should. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah, no, that's awesome. It is awesome. All right, guys. Well, do you have any last words? All right. Well, thanks for listening to the Sermon Remixed. Hopefully you'll go back and read chapter 5. Catch up on chapter 6. Look forward to chapter 7, part 1, because we're divided into two.
Yep.
Michael has part 2. And you've got a lot of fun sayings in there. There's a lot of great stuff in 7.
Oh, I just would like to say I am the bread of life was the first I am statement.
That's right.
The second one is I am the light of the world, which I also get to preach on.
It's great. If you need my slides from that sermon.
That's a few weeks. A few weeks from now.
To you. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. If you got questions about the Gospel of John or anything else, email them to thehealingthecity@gmail.com or villagersonline@gmail.com. Thank you very much.